Oh, my. Thank you. I asked her to please make sure I had water, and then I left it there. I'm Kathy. I'm an alcoholic. And, oh, joy. I got a call. I'm not even sure who called me. I think it was probably John. I hear people talking about John. Last Saturday, I was driving up to L.A. to drop stuff off for my son in college, and I was giving all the reasons why he probably should find somebody else to speak because he should really review the work I had done here before and make sure that he really wanted me. And then I felt guilty because I realized that after I hung up the phone that if it was one of my sponsees, I'd be telling her to come speak. So I called him back, and here I am. And hopefully I do okay with this. Okay, my sobriety date is March 21st, 1984. And my home group is the Great Fact Group, located over by Grossmont High School, in some circles known as the best meeting in the world. And many of us are here tonight, so we're well represented. And thank you guys for coming. Thanks, James. And, okay. And so here goes. Part of why I wonder, you know, I really enjoyed what you said, Joe, and why I wonder about me speaking is because when, you know, I didn't have a real struggle when I got sober. And I, you know, when I got sober fairly young, and on the outside there were a lot of things really going on pretty well for me when I got sober. And so sometimes I feel like, you know, what I would have to say wouldn't fit in for, you know, a lot of the speakers that I hear. But then I know that there are people out there that are like me, you know, and that they need to hear this stuff too. When I got sober, the last time I drank, I was a college student. I was in my second to last semester at San Diego State. I was on the dean's list. I was living with a man who I am now married to, who came to see me speak tonight, and I appreciate that. Thank you, Tim. And I was living with him at the time, and we had two cars, and he was working, and I was going to school, and a lot of times he'd come home, and I'd already, you know, because school doesn't last as long as work, and I'd already be well into a bit of beer and maybe passed out on the couch and, you know, ready to get going for the rest of the evening. Of course, beer wasn't the only thing I was involved with. And that last time that I drank, I was drinking wine, and I was at San Diego State, and I went into Monty's Den and drank a liter or so of wine with a friend of mine and went home. And it was, I don't know, early in the afternoon. I was supposed to be working at a professional meeting that night, checking in members of the profession that I hoped to work in like 6 or 8 months and would be interviewing with in less than that. And I went up the block to another person's house and hung out there for a while. Well, long story short, my husband got home. He came down and found me. He was pissed because the car was half on the driveway, half on the grass. It was like 5 o'clock in the evening. You know, I was three sheets to the wind and thought I was going to go work this thing at 6 o'clock. And my solution was, to show him, and I got on the freeway and drove out to La Mesa from North Park at 5 o'clock at night. And went over to a friend of mine's house and slept on her couch while she went to a business meeting. And when she got home, by then I'd slept it off pretty well. It was 10, 11 o'clock at night. And we were talking, and I kind of laughed because, you know, ego served me well on many occasions, and this was one of them, because one of the things that got me sober was that she told me that night that I really wasn't very attractive when I drank. And that was news to me, you know. So ego can, you know, be helpful at times too. In addition to that, the 21st of March is also my husband's birthday. And I felt like, so it was the 20th was the night when I did all that driving and whatnot. And I felt like one more time I'd screwed up his birthday, you know, And it took me about 7 years into sobriety to figure out that he did not like his birthday, that it really had nothing to do with me, that he was going to find a reason to sulk anyway on his birthday. He's gotten way better with that, by the way. Appreciate that, Tim. So the next day I called AA Central and I went to a meeting. And you know, it's interesting because when I got here, I thought that I had this really high bottom and everything, and I really held on to that section in the book. I'm not a very good book thumper, but there's the section in the book where it talks about the yets and it talks about potential alcoholics, and that's what I held on to for myself that allowed me to stay here, because I hadn't lost everything, you know, because I hadn't had it yet to lose it, for one thing, but I hadn't lost everything, and so that portion of the book really helped me to be able to stay around. And then I found that the longer I was sober, the more I realized that a lot of those things that I thought hadn't happened to me had happened to me. And I realized that, you know, I didn't think I'd ever had a blackout. But when I was 18 years old, which at the time the drinking age in Idaho was 19. It was some years ago. And so I still wasn't old enough for that. And that's where I lived, was Idaho. And I'd been hanging out in bars because, you know, that wasn't that hard to do. And I called the cops and reported my car stolen. And found it in front of another bar, you know, a little bit later. So something, you know, one way or another, I was probably in a blackout. You know, I either took the car to the other bar or I gave someone else the keys. You know, something happened. I don't think anybody stole the keys from me. But, you know, it took me several years into sobriety to get clarity about that one. And then another thing was, another time with a blackout, I found my purse one morning. I was in the Navy. I joined the Navy when I was 18, and they were much more liberal in the Navy back in those days. And I was on Midway Island, stationed on Midway Island, and one morning I found my purse hanging on the turnstile of this cannon they had out in this park. So I just stumbled across it, you know. I didn't know it was there. So something tells me that that, too, was an example of maybe perhaps having a blackout. I thought I'd never lost a job. And then still at that time, when I was still 18 years old in Idaho, one day I called in sick to work to a restaurant that I worked at up the block. And I was hanging out in the bar, and all the managers showed up in the bar. And so I kind of ducked out the back, you know, and went in and quit the job. You know, and so, see, I hadn't lost a job because I quit the job. And they said something about me being in that bar. I said, how could I have been in the bar? I'm 18. I'm not old enough to be in the bar. But in my mind, I had never lost a job behind alcohol. You know, I said I was in the Navy. They didn't fire a lot of people for being involved in alcohol or drugs, for that matter, back then. They're a little less tolerant of that these days. But I'm old enough that I'm actually Vietnam-era veteran, so they were taking anybody they could get. I guess the point of that is that, you know, I had all those yets that I was that I thought I was having to hold on to and look at, and the longer I got sober and the more time I spent, the more I realized that I had already lived a lot of those things, and. See, and I'm done now, so that didn't take long. Okay, so, yeah, thank you. Okay, so I guess I just got sober, right? I guess I could tell you a little bit more. I started drinking, you know, like a lot of you, when I was like 12, 13 years old, and I came home totally shit-faced the first time when I was going on 14, and I had thrown up all over, and my boyfriend's, I think he had a, a cougar. I think it was a cougar. They were kind of like Mustangs, but not. Anyway. and I had thrown up all over in his car, and I had my shirt buttoned to my pants, and my mom was waiting up when I got home, and it was not a pretty scene, you know. And I tried to assure her that nothing had happened from a sexual standpoint because I'd been too damn sick. And that, you know, and that was the beginning. And within a couple of years, I was indulging in other extracurricular activities as well. All through high school, or a large part of through high school, I used to carry those little squeeze limes. I would fill them up with wine or bourbon or whatever you could get away with taking out of the liquor cabinet at the time. And drank that at school in the morning before I ever went to classes. I was kind of popular out there. There was the island and where everybody would go smoke, and I was kind of popular out there. And then at lunch, we'd be driving around drinking six-packs and smoking pot, you know, and that's what I did. I graduated like 59th, I think, out of a class of 70, and had SAT scores in like the 96th percentile. So, you know, and then I was always angry because people were telling me I wasn't living up to my potential. I said I lived under the onus of potential. I got done with school. You know, we were doing all kinds of stuff through school. Got done with high school, and the day I graduated from high school, I moved out, and that weekend I moved in with my boyfriend and his mother and her boyfriend, and didn't know why my mom was really upset. That was a pretty interesting period of life. That lasted for a while out there. It was out in the country. And then they were much bigger bigwigs, whatever, than I was. And they started having all this drug traffic stuff happening. And ultimately, everybody was dispersing and going different directions. And I went to Oregon. And I was just over 18, and it was 1976, and the economy sucked, and I couldn't get a job, so I was at the unemployment office, and they said I hadn't worked enough the prior year, so I couldn't have an employment, and across the street was the Navy recruiting office, so I went over there and joined the Navy, and I did my 4 years in the Navy. That's where I met my husband. That whole time, you know, I was on Midway Island, and every night on Midway Island, all we did was dance and drink, dance and drink. It was, gosh, a lot of fun. And that, consequently, that's how I lost my purse and various other things. Then I got transferred back over to the States. I was at the amphibious base at Coronado, and I continued, you know, to drink a lot. And I was in supply, so I was in supply. And again, I say there was a far more tolerant military at that time. And then when I got out of the Navy, and you know, they used to call me on the phone sometimes and say, you know, would you come back and all this kind of stuff. And I would try to explain to them how they had screwed up letting me go because I could have been the champion of the enlisted man. And it took me a lot of years to figure out they did not want a champion of the enlisted man in the military. So anyway, I wasn't very far. I got done with the Navy, and I went straight into school. And, you know, before I finished 4 years of school, I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my drinking career only lasted about 13 years, probably. Yeah, because I was 26 when I got sober. I told you about that last day of drinking, and what I didn't tell you is that, you know, for I don't know how much time before then, I had tried all of those, well, a number of those things that it says in the book in chapter 3. You know, I knew that the problem was actually beer because I didn't like the taste of beer, so I had to drink it while it was very cold, and then it would be gone. So then I had to get another beer. And that was my whole problem, was I had to drink something besides beer. So I started drinking wine. And then I would go on just 30 days of just having ginger ale. And then, you know, I tried a whole bunch of those things. And just recently, so I've been sober for over 26 years. And I think it was last year I was talking to my aunt because I had this memory. My dad got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous in 82. And I had this memory of going to a anniversary party, 25th anniversary party for my aunt and my uncle. And they were talking, my dad was sober then, and he was talking to me about AA. And then my recollection was that a year or so later, I got sober. And I called that AA after hours number. I called that number drunk. And a couple of times. I'm sure I'm the only one that did that. And I just found out like a year or so ago that actually that anniversary party was probably the weekend before the Wednesday that I got sober. I know I got sober on Wednesday. And, you know, for 25 years, I had thought there'd been a year in between. So here I say, you know, my high bottom and how I thought all of this. And obviously, I was in a little more trouble than I thought I was in. Okay, so now I'm getting sober. And I went to Pathfinder Service Center. They were on 30th Street. Not the recovery home, but they had a service center on 30th Street between El Cajon and University. And I lived over on Idaho Street, so it was very convenient. And that's the first place I went to a meeting on that Wednesday. And I was sitting in there crying. And somebody said, do you want to talk to one of the counselors? And I explained to her why I was an adult child of an alcoholic, and the guy I lived with was probably an alcoholic, and maybe I had a drinking problem. And she said, yeah, I understand all that. There's this closed women's meeting I think you should go try. And that was on Friday, and I went to that closed women's meeting. I went to a meeting at Pathfinders again on Thursday, and I'd heard that you should do 90 meetings in 90 days, and I did do 90 meetings in 90 days. During that time, my sister got married in Idaho, and I flew back there, and my dad picked me up at the airport and took me to a meeting. And during that time, some point during that time, Tim moved out. And that was very stressful for me. He didn't move out. He just wasn't staying there, you know. He was sleeping on somebody's couch. He didn't pack all his shit. But I had no income, you know, and I was a student and all of this. So that was very stressful. I was very worried about, you know, what he was going to do. And someone gave me the 24-hour-a-day book and told me that I should read that. And I spent a lot of time reading that and crying and going to meetings at Pathfinders. And there was this gay guy over there that was into baking bread. And so he'd come over and we'd bake bread together, you know. And he taught me how. And I baked really good bread for quite a few years. And I wish I could remember his name. Gosh. Oh, no. That was a long time ago. So we moved from North Park in 86, so I wasn't going to meetings out there anymore. And actually, Pathfinders was kind of a revolving door as far as sobriety there. You know, a lot of people went in and out and in and out. And I hung out at the back. I smoked cigarettes back then, so I hung out at the back at this couch and smoked cigarettes with these people and went to dances when they had dances and dragged Tim along. Driving, designated driver, whatever you call it, on New Year's Eve that first year, and Tim went along and did that with me. I got active in service. I was a coffee maker at that women's meeting. I remember going to that women's meeting and being about 30 days sober and bursting into tears and telling them that I was scared to death of them. And see, this is why I brought the tissues up, because I knew this could happen. Because I was scared to death of women. You know, my experience with women had not been good. I'm one of four sisters, and I had a dad who still have a dad, who really wasn't all that fond of women. And I actually had a mother who I don't think was all that fond of women. Didn't really respect women. And somehow I grew up not thinking much of women except for me, you know, that I had this intellect that was above that. And I also had been, you know, I mean, girls can be nasty. And I think that's what started the lime or the lemon thing out on the island, you know, was dealing with some girls. And it's like, okay, fine, you know, and then all the guys were around me and ha, got them. Anyway, I hadn't had good relationships with women. And it scared me to be in that women's meeting with all those women because I was 26 and they all looked to me, they were probably my age, they all looked to me like they were really, really old, and I'm not really, really old. Just in case some of you are looking at me and thinking that. So that women's meeting, one of the things that they did that I really liked is they had a temporary sponsor list, and I took a name off of that list. And they passed around, they had little phone books, and they put numbers in the phone books. And I started calling the different ones of those people, particularly after Tim moved out, and I was all flipping out. And that gave me practice in actually reaching out and touching people, or talking to people and asking for help. Asking for help is still not a strong suit of mine. I remember hearing in that meeting, you know, taking a walk when it's really bad. Take a walk, walk around the block, smell the flowers, take a break. And there was one day when I did just literally that, you know. I walked around the block and, you know, stopped and smelled roses. And I made it through and I didn't drink. And when I got sober, I figured that I would probably stop drinking. Pot was on a 90-day hiatus, and we'd, you know, reevaluate after that time. I decided that, you know, based on what I had found and the people that I was with, and not wanting to be separated from that fellowship, that I would not smoke the pot either. Saying that I was an alcoholic, I don't know if I believed I was an alcoholic when I first got here, but saying it was not a problem. You know, it's just words. Who cares? And it took me some time to get, you know, maybe even years, to get to the point of really, 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 really believing that I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful that I was allowed to come into these rooms and say the things that I needed to say and be as obnoxious as I needed to be at times. And one of the things that I loved about AA is I felt like that was one place I could go and say whatever I needed to say and nobody would tell me I couldn't come back. And that was really important. It took me a while to work the steps. I finally did my first three, probably, I don't even remember, probably fairly quickly. I remember my fourth and fifth because, again, ego came to my rescue, and I was taking a two-year cake, and I wasn't going to take a cake and say I hadn't worked my fourth step. So I worked my fourth step, and I worked my fifth step that night. I met my sponsor for dinner before the meeting and did my fifth step, you know. But I got it done, you know, and that was just the first one. And it was really hard. It's still hard for me to work, to write fourth steps because I don't remember things really well. I don't carry resentments really well. I forget what I'm pissed about until something comes up to remind me. But I mean, to just be sitting around and try to remember all the things that pissed me off, that's really hard for me. So my first fourth step was pretty lame. And then subsequently I went through and did it. I just listed all my family members, my sisters, my mom, my dad, you know, some people at work, things like that, know that they had pissed me off at some point and dredged up, you know, the time that I got the spanking when it should have been Nancy, you know, and that kind of stuff. But that was the best I could do at that point. And since then I've used a different formats. I did that with that one. I used the columns out of the book. And I still look at things and think through things with the columns out of the book. But I've also used other questionnaires that have helped me to delve more deeply into some of those things that I don't think about. You know, like the sexual inventory. It took me a long time to realize that those notches on my belt, you know, that it really was not that big of an accomplishment to get a guy to go to bed with me. You know, it took me a while to figure that out. I thought I had one on them, you know. So, anyway. But it took a sexual inventory to get that figured out. Let's see, what else? Where am I time-wise? Oh, Lordy. I can dance and sing too. ultimately I did get through working through all the steps. I have worked them in different formats, different meeting formats, and the first one that I went to, actually I think it's still going. Excuse me. A book study, big book and 12 and 12 study over on Zion at the Lutheran Church, and it's on Tuesday nights, and I think it's still going, and that's the first step study that I ever went to, and I still see people in meetings today that went to that step study. Since I have been sober, you know, life has happened, and I've had various things that I've had to walk through, as we all do. And, I think I was talking about the being of service earlier. And when I first got sober and I was going to that women's meeting, one of the things that I did, there was a lady there named Barbara. We called her Lady Barbara. There were five Barbaras at that meeting. We called her Lady Barbara, and she needed rides. She was probably in her 70s at that time, and she was newly sober. And she lived in Kensington, and I lived in North Park, so I would pick her up and bring her out to the meeting that was on Lake Murray. And that gave me a purpose for being at that meeting. That, that gave me a right to be there. I also took on the coffee commitment there. And I, at that step study that I was talking about, within my first couple years, I was secretary there. And that's one of the things that I learned early in sobriety that I have fallen back on many times. There have been times when I... my Wednesday noon meeting that I go to on a regular basis, and many people are here from that now. Thank you, guys. that I started going back to when work circumstances allowed it. I felt uncomfortable there, and so I did what I learned early in sobriety, and I volunteered to be the secretary. And I know that if I have a commitment like that and I have to sit there for that long, within 6 months I will feel like I belong and I have a right to be there. I've done that... with other meetings as well. And so that is my being of service to others. And then there came a point when I was just over 3 years sober, 3.5 years sober, we got pregnant, and which was a good thing. And then when I was about 3 years and 9 months sober, I got thrown in the hospital with complications in the pregnancy, and I was put on strict bed rest for the rest of my pregnancy. And women in this program brought meetings to my house. And see, here I go again. Okay, breathe. By then I was doing a little bit better with the women. But they brought meetings to my house. And that was harder for me to accept. It's a lot easier to go pick you up than to ask you to pick me up. It's a lot easier to take meetings to the hospital to see you than it is to ask you to come help me. It's a lot easier to show up to listen to you speak than to ask you to come listen to me speak. But I did it. I asked people to come hear me speak, and damn, y'all showed up. Half the people here. Won't do that again. No. Oh, God. But I've shared with people, and I share with people that I sponsor a lot of times when there's something that they need to be asking for, when they need help. that, you know, there's no opportunity for me to give you a ride if you don't ask me for a ride, or if you don't ask, put out to the group that you need a ride. There's no way that I know you need help unless you let me know. And then since I say that to them, I have to hear that for myself, and I have to do that for myself. And this is, I've been around a few days, and I still have to struggle with that. And so that was the complications in the pregnancy. And that was actually, there was a point during that I got very, very scared, because it was like one thing after another was going wrong. And it was to the point where I was, you know, what's going to happen next? And I was in a lot of fear. And it was one of those times that is a blessing in life, because it was, I got to sit there one day and decide whether I was going to trust God or if I was going to just like go nuts. And I chose to trust God. And that baby's now 22 years old and playing in the minor leagues in baseball. And I'm so proud of him. And we have another son who's also a baseball player. I'm so proud of both of them. And I know that it never would have happened were I not sober. There was a time when the younger one was a couple years old that Tim and I separated. And that was a very difficult time. I was almost 10 years sober when that happened. We were separated for 6 months. And I spent a lot of time praying and I was calling my sponsor a lot. She kind of lost touch with me after that. I don't know. I don't know. And we worked through that. And we're still married. We've been married 25 years now. Let's see. What other times happened? I don't know. Just life happens. My mom, then in 2005, when I had about 20 years of sobriety, I had that kid who's in minor league baseball now, was going to be a senior in high school, and my mom had cancer. And she had gotten sober, by the way, along the way. So both of my parents got sober. And I wasn't afraid I was going to drink. I didn't feel like I was going to drink, but I felt like I was going to totally fuck up my life. You know, I was going to sabotage my job. I was going to I was not behaving well, you know. And so my solution there, I did what I learned early in sobriety. I went back to 90 meetings in 90 days. At that time, I'd only really been going to one meeting consistently because I got all involved in, you know, raising kids and doing all this stuff. You know, they were both majorly in baseball, and we were all involved in Little League. And I became president of Little League, which I do not advise. I really, really advise against. Tracy. because that was probably worse than... That was a bad, bad situation. When I was president of Little League, they all know. Yeah, my Wednesday people know that was a bad, bad situation. And so I had slipped off, and I was really only going to one meeting consistently a week. So I went back to 90 meetings in 90 days. I didn't make it that whole way because my mom passed away. I was able to be back there with her. She was in Idaho, and I was actually with her when she died. And I had been to a meeting earlier that night to her women's group. And AJ, you know, later on in that spring, he wanted to quit baseball, and he had a big scholarship to a good school and all this stuff, and he wanted to quit baseball, you know. And fortunately, I had picked up meetings, one of them being my home group, during that time when I was going to those 90 meetings in 90 days. I think I made it about 45 or 60. I'm not sure. Mom died on the 13th. of October. And I've stuck with that now. I consistently go to about 4 meetings a week. And and I have been of service in that home group, too. I have been secretary. I have been leader. I have been bell ringer. I was kind of a not very good bell ringer, I have to admit. I even actually made coffee the other day. And I might take that on next fall, but not in the spring. Can't do things in the spring. So what's the point of that? I don't know. The point is that, you know, life continues to happen, you know, and what I find is that the basics that I got in AA are what gets me through a lot of those things when life happens. It's reaching out to the fellowship. It's showing up. It's like during that time when I wasn't going to many meetings, I always went to at least one meeting a week and tried to be consistent as to what meeting that was, because every time I heard about anybody going out, it seemed like the first thing I heard was that they'd let their meetings go. And I was not. I was scared to death to let my meetings go. You know, for all that time that I didn't know for sure if I was an alcoholic or whatever else, there's no way, you know, there came a point in my sobriety that it doesn't matter whether I had, because I didn't have withdrawals, see? So was I really an alcoholic? From everything I've heard and read and whatnot, I could have withdrawals next week should I decide to go out and drink now. So it's a progressive disease, and today I don't have to test it, and I'm really grateful for that. I have so many blessings in my life. My husband and I are, you know, going on this whole new venture thing with the kids being out of the house, and it's like, who are you? And we're trying to figure that out and start working on things like the house and our relationship and just, you know, what was it like? It's really hard to remember. What was it like 23 years ago before the kids, you know? And I don't want to give that up. I don't want to lose that, and I know that that if I drank, it would be gone. My kids, you know, both of them got to go to good schools, and because they had scholarships, not because we had the money to put them through good schools. And the reason they had scholarships is because they were able to be there and do what they needed to do. They did the work, but if we weren't there to support them, if I had been drinking, you know, maybe they would have made it, but it would have been a hell of a lot harder for them. So I'm really grateful for my sobriety. For the friends, I'm reaching out more to the women again. You know, there was a lot of years where I was kind of staying away from the women. There were just a couple of them. I got what I termed to be burned, perhaps, by three of them. I got abandoned. I got abandoned by some women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so for a long time, I wasn't going to count on that. I'm very self-sufficient in the first place. Like I said, it's hard for me to ask for help. I think that's one of the things I'm trying to learn in my relationship with my husband right now, is how to, you know, not be all in charge all the time, and not how to be vulnerable, and how to, you know, not be on top of it all. It's not easy, but I know that this program can help me with that too. You know, that's part of my character defects. There's this balance thing. I've said for years, you know, my purpose this time in life, this life around, was to figure out balance, and I haven't figured it out yet. But, you know, my self-sufficiency and my brain power and my, you know, ability to get things done has carried me a long ways and a lot of times, but it's also blocked a lot of things from me, and I want to find balance. I guess it was about a year ago. I went on a beach retreat with a bunch of women who have been doing that for years, and I knew they were doing it, and I wasn't going to the women's meeting that they were all doing it with, so I never went. Well, this time I got invited, and I went along, and now I'm going to a women's meeting on a consistent basis again, and I'm breaking down some of those barriers and getting close to some of the women again. And because the women are who I need to be close to, you know, And I know that. So outside of my dear friend Russell here, I have men who are friends in AA, but I don't have, you know, I don't have the real closeness. And I need to open up to the women to be able to have that. And I need to be willing to do that. So, working on that one. Should keep me busy for another 25 years, probably. What else? I don't know. This is why I was apologizing before I started, y'all. I don't know. I'm just grateful. I'm just grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous and for rooms like this and for a place that let me come in and be who I was and say what I needed to say. And when I got here, I was an alcoholic addict. And then I listened to a tape one time where it talked about that, and it talked about that describing myself as an alcoholic addict was just one more way of making me different, separate, a little bit different than you, keeping me apart. So I dropped the addict, and I'm just an alcoholic. And I am blessed to be an alcoholic that hasn't had a craving for alcohol in a long time. Occasionally I think about wine tours. But I always get over that really, really fast. So do I have to keep talking, or can I stop? Thank you so much. All right.